Welcome to the Intercut Podcast Channel, the weekly place to hear the latest on movies, TV, and entertainment that people can't cut away from. I'm your co-host, Zachary Shevchen. Joining me, I knew whenever I got there, he'd be there, and then I woke up. It's Arturo Zurita.
I feel it's going to be a good one, man. Call it.
Yeah.
Call it.
Call it. I can't call it. It's too hard to call. These are two of the greatest films in the Joel and Ethan Coen oeuvre, that just two of the undeniable five-star masterpieces. I think there's a few kind of like undeniable masterpieces in that Coen brothers catalog. These two definitely stand out because Joel and Ethan Coen have made 18 feature films as a filmmaking team. And while many of them are among the best films of the 90s and 21st century, from goofy satirical comedies to existential dramas to stark serious thrillers, the pair have transcended genre to become among the most critically beloved filmmakers working today. And though many of their films are celebrated and several others have received awards attention, these are the only two films that have won Joel and Ethan Coen an Oscar across that career. Those films are 1996's Fargo and 2007's No Country for Old Men. Made just about a decade apart from one another, Fargo and No Country both exemplify many of the qualities that have made the Coens a singularly compelling experience in film. From their deadpan humor, to their sudden, unglamorous bursts of violence, to its centering of middle American characters that are often not the focus of prestige films. They're among the best crime thrillers to have been made in the past 30 years, and both are indisputable classics. But Arturo, which one of these two classics did you see first, and what did you think about it at the time?
I think it was Fargo. I had rented it from Blockbuster when I was going down my whatever IMDb 250 list, and I remember checking it out. I thought it was real. How was I supposed to know any different in junior high school? I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is what happened in Fargo. Of course, they talk like Minnesotans in Fargo. Like, what am I supposed to think of this? And assuming that they didn't put that in their other movies that I had already known, The Big Lebowski didn't seem to be a true story. So why would they put it in this one? And I went a while before I realized, no, it is not a true story. It turns out that's something you can just say.
That whole based on a true story bit is so funny. And I feel like it really smartly anticipates like our American obsession with true crime. But it just ends up being this really like weird note that has gone to like actually like make this film a little bit more resonant in a weird way.
I think it's something that they've been able to use for all of the seasons of Fargo, the TV series. They still keep that as a thing for every single episode. And I think you've got it on the money. Before true crime really hit off the way it did in this world, they kind of still saw it in tabloids and newspapers and all these different things. That's what they were commenting on. They were just so ahead of it before people started breaking the fourth wall on what things should be, you know. Nowadays, they kind of had that down. They knew that they were going to get you to listen in a little bit more. And then also kind of question, once you realize it, why did I find it more serious when it said true story as opposed to when it wasn't?
Absolutely. So Fargo was the first of the films released back in 1996. It was nominated for 7 Oscars, and it won 2 of them. It won Joel and Ethan Coen the Best Screenplay Oscar, their first, but it also was the first Best Actress win for Frances McDormand, Joel's wife. The film was nominated for 5 other Oscars, which it lost, including Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor for William H. Macy, Best Director, which was only to Joel at the time. Ethan didn't have the co-directing credit then. It also,
I've been seeing that. That's weird.
Yeah, it was also an early Best Cinematography nomination for Roger Deakins, and it got a Best Editing nomination. You know who gets their Best Editing nominations?
I just pulled it up when you were away. The Roderick James guy, but they used to have an IMDb for him. I tried pulling it up, and I couldn't.
That Roderick James is the pseudonym which they use as themselves. They edit their own movies. They just don't take credit for it for whatever reason. But
someone was clever. They went in and they created a separate Roderick James, and it's for a bunch of like, I don't know, Bill Cosby, Bukowski Part 2. Man, IMDb got too slick, but I think they need to give him back. They need that, and we need the Charlie Kaufman's brother IMDb back too.
Exactly, right? Some of the only fictional people have ever been nominated for Academy Awards.
At that point, they kind of deserve one.
Yeah.
Someone asked, do you know what won in 96? I want to say it was like Shakespeare in Love. It wasn't Shakespeare in Love. It was 96.
Ooh, was that the English Patient like year? I feel like that was English Patient.
No, it was, right? It was English Patient because I had just searched this up for 96 because Taste of Things.
Juliette Binoche. Yeah.
And so that's how I knew it was 96. Ah, what a year. Shouldn't have gone to them. I would have definitely given it to Fargo. I think Fargo in retrospect, is 100% right? A movie. Oh, it's easily.
Quickly, the nominees were The English Patient, Fargo, Jerry Maguire, Secrets and Lies, and Shine. I mean, I'd hear an argument for Jerry Maguire, but I think this is easily.
I'd hear an argument for Jerry Maguire, but it's
Fargo. I think Fargo is easily the best movie.
It's Fargo's.
Yeah.
For sure.
So yeah, this also has like just some really like iconic contributions from, whether it's actors or craftsmen that we love. We already mentioned the Frances McDormand performance winning the Oscar, but it's interesting too because it is such a contrast to her later Oscar wins, which see her as this like really stern, serious, older woman, and here you have that like Minnesota nice. You have the goofy Fargo accent contrasted with her police detective character, and it's such an interesting part for her. She's so incredible in it too, and it's the kind of part where I can't think of like many actors who I would trust with it, but she does such an incredible job in it.
I think one of the things that she gets down is the tone, and that's something that even in the other one that we had rewatched when we were together for Sundance and Burn After Reading. It's like, I think she has four for a reason. I'm pretty sure it's four. I could be misnumbering.
It might be
them,
three.
Dang, I'm just giving her the extra one already.
No,
then.
Four. You're right.
Did I get it right? Because fourth would have been Nomad. No, the way that she's able to handle it here. One thing that Alina found surprising was she thought she was going to be more in the forefront of the movie, especially when like the way people recount it. But like, I think William H. Macy is really the one that stands out a lot on my rewatch because like I already know her. She gets memed to death. But William H. Macy is playing a scumbag that you follow through all of his ups and downs. There is never a reason to like this man. When he is at work screwing people over, when he's trying to get his wife killed, all of these different things that he's doing. But she comes in as almost like in the 90s, I felt had this really big era of what you were putting on screen really depended on where the character sided on. And she was the complete opposite of William H. Macy's character in every interaction. It's almost like they show you every sequence possible to show you how they would do opposite things. I thought she was incredible. I literally thought of her performance today. It's going to sound so random when watching Rebecca Ferguson and Dude. There is a particular, really? I know it's going to sound so out of left field, but it's the ability to take charge when you're pregnant and how some can see that as a, almost like a weakness, but it's you being able to do your job with that. That just shows how much more, adept you are to it. I thought she's fantastic in this role, even rewatching it. But I will say out of all the ones that we've been rewatching, it may not be the best performance she's given in a Coen Brothers movie for me.
Yeah. She's given some great ones. So I that's stiff company, but yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting performance. You mentioning that she's not as big of a part of this as you remembered. I had forgot how late in the movie she actually shows up. She's not in the movie until about half an hour into it. Yeah. Whereas the William H. Macy character, I think it's such a great performance and kind of is like the quintessential William H. Macy because he's able to put on this sort of like really flustered kind of mannerisms. But he has, as you mentioned, this really scummy quality that he hides with this very like nice guy facade. It's the classic like
salesman.
Quote unquote nice guy. Yeah, very, very much a car salesman. Very much fits the mold there. But yeah, I think he's so good in this movie and it sort of highlights why he's kind of like a very unique actor in that he's a little bit squirrely, right? Oddly,
what
one of
happened
the other,
to him?
I don't know. I wish he was in this mode a little bit more because one of the only other people who I feel like can pull off this kind of part is a Steve Buscemi, who's also in this movie and is very good, albeit in maybe even a scummier kind of role. Just really a real great dirtbag energy among the cast. But I just... I don't know. There's so many small parts. I even think about what's his name? John Carroll Lynch, who plays Francis McDormand's husband, Norm, in the movie. He's like got just such a, like, Norm is kind of the perfect name for it. He's such like a normie, suburban dad kind of dude.
He has like one through line that's happening. He goes, I think they're going to vote today. And then like the next time you see him, he's still on the same conversation.
Yep. Yep. And just the way they're able to contrast this like really depraved, escalating crime with the normalcy and kind of like simpleness of the setting, yeah, and the townspeople and the conversations, particularly, like, this is one of the movies that really kind of gets at the Coen's ability to undercut the seriousness of their situations with this very, very plain dialogue that kind of like feels almost more authentic because it's very ordinary. It's kind of like people who are just sort of figuring out what's going on as they find out about it, you know?
And I think that's why you mix a true story element to it. You mix these accents, you mix the dialogue, like you're saying, these very normal sounding names, and it reads like a transcript. It feels like they ripped it off of somebody, but it's those details that kind of showcase to you how all of their movies are done. They put so much effort into all these little nuances to make them feel like actual living characters. I think that's why it's stood the test of time and why the show does it even better.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want to say better. I think it's why the show has been able to continue its legacy. And I think that's very profound. I don't want to overdo it, but five seasons in, I think some of these are just as good as the movie.
I don't know if better is the word, but the show is able to mine this situation, because I think what the Coens have made is something that, although it is very specific, it kind of is in a way something that is like a canvas that you can paint on top of and pull elements out of. And, you know, like, I was also going to mention the Mike Yamagita character, who Stephen Park plays like hilariously, this old high school friend of Marge's. And it's this like really minor role, but with it, there's like a whole depth of what he's going through, because we find out that like the wife that he says just died recently, he never even married her. And like, I think they have this ability to kind of bring in these characters who you understand who they are within like one or two lines of dialogue, right?
Yes.
They're very good at painting you a very clear picture in very few brushstrokes, but it makes the worlds that much deeper, and it feels like you can dive in and do, you know, five seasons of Fargo that sort of iterate on different aspects of this original movie.
Bro, because I had just pulled up Steve Park, who you had mentioned. I was like, why does he look so familiar? I didn't even see it in the movie. Wes Anderson in the last two movies, playing the father, but specifically the chef.
The chef in French Dispatch. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He's also, speaking of the Coen brothers, he's the father in A Serious Man, of the guy who tries to bribe, the student who tries to bribe him. So he's worked with the Coens more than once.
Oh, I'm going to see him again. I saw he was in Falling Down. That's also a really good pick to have here. If you're mentioning just movies from the 90s that really hit, there's another one. But back to Fargo. The way that they were able to bring all the characters is fantastic. And then reading up on it and some of the special features, they had no snow when they filmed. I would have never guessed. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just so down convincing to the production design, you would think that there was a blizzard. They had none of it. There was like one of the ones where they showcase, they call themselves out, and it's the parking lot scene. There's no snow in the back. I'm like watching it and I'm not even paying attention to the back. I was like, wow, just the mastery to be able to craft a lot of these sequences on top of the performances and everything else is really good.
Yeah. And speaking of that snow, like, so much of it is so iconic, but just those opening moments when you have that blanket of snow and you see the car emerge through it as the music swells. I mean, the Roger Deakins cinematography is so great, but that Carter Burwell score, that is one of my all-time favorite film scores. It's ominous, but it's a little bit like a march. It pulls you along. It just sort of has this epic quality too, almost like the spaghetti westerns. I really, really dug all those aspects of it.
Getting into Frances, I had seen her talk a little bit about the movie, and she gave some pretty interesting bits. One, as we know, they met on Blood Simple.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was pregnant with the director's child in this movie. I didn't realize she was pregnant during the movie, so I thought that was like a pretty added element to it, but I thought that was pretty cool. But it's more so, I had a line over here. She had made a mention of something dealing with her character and the husband. She said that to them, they were both cops. And the idea is that you're supposed to take note in the movie that they both realized she was the better cop. And so he retired, and that's why he's doing what he's doing.
Mm.
She was a better cop even pregnant. And I'm like, that's such a fascinating thing to have in the background. So that was a nice little note to have this time around. And then I had given a mention in the last thing we recorded about the Zellner brothers, another duo who's been making a lot of movies together. They just so happen to have made something that's connected to this. I think you've seen Kumiko. Let me pull this up. I'll see you right again.
Yeah,
Kumiko the Treasure Hunter. Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, completely forgot. The whole reason she's on the journey is because she saw Fargo. This girl thinks it's a true story, and they still buried the treasure.
Yeah, she goes to look for the Kumiko briefcase.
I forgot Kumiko was a true story.
Yeah.
And the Zellners just adapted it. So if you needed even more Fargo reading into how this all gets caught up into almost people still believing it's a true story, this is how. Kumiko is a pretty interesting movie, and these two brothers continue to have fascinating stuff on the horizon with Sasquatch and such. But
definitely.
I think Fargo is definitely one that stood the test of time. Like I mentioned with the series, the way they've been able to connect things has been impressive to follow. And I think is almost like the True Detective series that no one wants to call True Detective, but is better than sometimes seasons of True Detective, even if some people may not agree. Completely different tones, but I think it gets it down beautifully. And I think it's been a fantastic miniseries as well as a movie that's held up.
Definitely. It definitely
isn't it crazy does these weren't the things the True
Detective
two?
Has wanted to do.
For Inner Cuties?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise that people want to see us talk about these movies because they're very popular.
I'm saying these weren't even the top two that the Inner Cuties picked.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of the bracket. That's how stacked these guys are.
Exactly. When we did our test bracket run with the Inner Cuties, they did not pick these two movies.
So, yeah, just another thing to add there. But you had mentioned Roger Deakins. Another thing that ties both of these movies together, and I listened to a podcast from him where he's breaking these down, and it's so fascinating to hear him talk about shooting both movies, but also comparing them both. And he was bringing up comparisons that I'm like, yo, this man should be a video essay.
Was this on Team Deacons?
I have
because he has that podcast with his son, right?
If he does, I know he has a podcast. This was off of a channel. I'm not sure where it came from because I just got it off YouTube.
Okay.
Joshua James Richards has a conversation. So whoever Joshua James Richards is. This was around Nomadland. So this is a clip I think someone just posted from the segment, but these are the things he came out with. One, he compares both endings as being almost in sync with each other, where you have two neutral law enforcement. He specifically called it, I forgot what he used, but it's like they're neutral. They're not necessarily...
good or evil.
They just want to make sure that there's order. And they both are having trouble understanding the evil that they've come across.
Yes.
I was like, that's a fascinating way to look at it.
Absolutely.
So that's all I got to offer from some of the stuff that I heard from Deakins as we lead into what I honestly think is the complete opposite.
Yeah, I mean,
I think they're so open Fargo.
There's a lot of things that connect these two movies, but they are also starkly different in very interesting ways. No Country for Old Men was released in 2007. That film was nominated for 8 Oscars. It won 4 of them. It won Best Director and Best Screenplay, which went to both of the Coens, both of those categories. It won Best Supporting Actor for Javier Bardem, and it won Best Picture, the only Coen Brothers film to have won Best Picture. It also was nominated for 4 other Oscars. It lost Best Cinematography, shout out Roger Deakins, you got yours eventually. Best Editing, again, Roger James, the most accoladed fake person in Academy Awards history, and it got the dual sound editing and sound mixing. Notable because this is a movie that has no music in it whatsoever. It is entirely atmospheric sound, diegetic sounds, and the dialogue, but it is masterful in how it utilizes them. There is very little talking through much of this movie, but I think what one of the things that really struck me in my rewatch of No Country most recently was the Coen's ability to stage these mostly dialogue-free, entirely music-free sequences that show and don't tell. They're incredibly tense. Like the first motel sequence where Josh Brolin's trying to figure out how to get the bag of money out of the vent, or the second motel sequence where he's watching the footsteps under the door approaching, or that moment when Javier Bardem blows up the car outside the pharmacy and then ends up sewing his bloody leg. Like, these are all things where you're watching the characters do certain actions that don't make sense to you as a viewer until you continue to see them work it out. And as they play along and as you lean in trying to figure out what's happening, they just ratchet up the tension and ratchet up the tension in these masterful ways that, to me, make No Country one of the most perfectly crafted thrillers I've ever seen. It just feels like one of those things where each action is so deliberate and causes a reaction that we see the consequences of in the film in a way that I really appreciate and find riveting in terms of just like filmmaking set pieces. It's a movie that just it does so little to dress itself up. It doesn't make big moments out of its bursts of violence. It doesn't really lean into the comedy. It will just sort of pepper it in here and there. I love the moment when Bardem is clearing out the motel room with the Mexican drug smugglers, and the one is hiding in the shower, and he closes the shower curtain before shooting him. It's so hilarious.
Just to not get the blood on him because it gets all over the curtains. It's like, it's what you're saying. It's like he has all of this already planned out.
Mm-hmm. But this is, to me, the Coen brothers movie where they got the pacing down absolutely perfectly. It just, it really pulls you along. And I feel like there's no wasted moment in this movie. Now, granted, a lot of people ultimately bristle on the ending, which kind of pulls you right out of the sort of like tense moment for moment crime thriller. But I think as I've grown older and as I've sat with this movie more, just the poeticness of that ending, the sort of journey that Tommy Lee Jones's character goes on and how he is forced to reckon with the changing world and his changing place in it, I find it to be so beautiful, and just it elevates this movie rather than takes away from it. So I don't know, man. I have trouble picking movies other than No Country for Old Men as my favorite Coen brothers movie. I may connect with certain elements in other Coen brothers movies more. Lately, I've been leaning towards A Serious Man a lot, but this is just the movie that is so easy for me to put on and sit back and enjoy.
Really?
It is just taut, tense, and in like extremely entertaining.
Wow.
Yeah. When's the last time you watched No Country for Old Men? Did you do the rewatch for this, or you've seen it recently enough that you felt like you could coast on it?
No, I rewatched it last week. I'm set with it. I like it more than I did before.
Good.
I have been saying that this year. Oh yeah, I'm not against your stuff at all. I'm not saying that at all. I will say I don't know about it being entertaining Saturday night with the boys. I am putting on sugar.
You don't want to coin toss to decide your fate on a Saturday?
No, bro. You're going to have Zach on a Saturday night. Call it. Call it. You have to pick.
Look, there are so many things, though, about these characters that I find entertaining. Like, even in the small moments, I love, like, when Josh Brolin is sort of investigating the remains of the shootout at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And there's that one guy in the car. There's that one guy in the car who wants him to close the door because he says there's coyotes. He says there are no lobos, and he leaves the door open. There ain't no lobos, he says.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is also my favorite. I think for a lot of these actors, this is my favorite mode that they get in. You kind of get like the cowboy hardness, the unfeeling Josh Brolin character. Javier Bardem particularly is so excellent. He's on it, yeah. I don't know if you want to talk about that now or save it for a little bit, but just one of the all-time scary villain performances.
I'd get into it. I will say for Brolin. Speaking of Dune, they're back together in Dune, bro. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
He wrote a poem and he called him Chigurh.
It's the iconic role. It's stuck with him for all these years. He knows the truth.
I think Denny knows it. There is a shot of both of them. I'm going to just leave it like that. Dune in theaters very soon.
Let's go.
These two together, I heard him talk about what it was like working with the Coens. He says they didn't tell him a thing. I'm like, what? He goes, you let me know when they direct, because I have no idea how they direct. I was just here. They wouldn't tell me a yes. They wouldn't tell me a no. I didn't know when I did something good. I didn't know when I did something bad. He said Woody Harrelson, who I always forget is in this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know why I forget Woody Harrelson is in this movie. He has one of the most profound talks as well. I don't know why. I just assume he was in another Western this year. When he comes in, he said Woody messed up his lines the entire time. And it was the only time he heard a reaction from the Coen brothers going, that's perfect, Woody. You got it. He was said he was so confused. He has no idea how they work. But with Chigurh, I don't even know where to begin talking about his technicality before you even get what he represents. Because every single time I watch the movie, I find something new with these themes of what the title No Country for Old Men really represents in terms of storytelling and for who really is the main character, which I think has become a really interesting discussion for the movie. Who do you think is the one leading it, and who is the one really telling the story? Because you may be following somebody, but that doesn't mean that they're the main character. You're almost having somebody narrate what that person is going through. But sticking with Chigurh, you were mentioning your favorite spots, little things that they did. My personal favorite has always been one where after he kills the lady, he comes up, but you don't see it. All you see him is checking his shoes just to make sure. I was like, damn, that's like the most evil, cleanest way to show it.
So that is a thing that I think some people debate over is whether or not he does kill her. I am on the same page as you. I think he's checking his shoes because he killed her. Some people think she lives. It's the coin that decides the fate.
Did they have it on mute? He gave a whole speech.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
I agree. I think if you're reading the character, he would kill her in that moment.
Let's get into
just
it.
Just wanted to point out that some people have a different
fascinating.
Take on that, but,
okay. Yeah. Well, interesting. So to me, the whole movie is from the perspective. If there was one character, who is it?
I think the thing that you were sort of alluding to is the movie almost tricks you into thinking it's Josh Brolin's character, Llewellyn.
Thank you.
But it's actually the Tommy Lee Jones character. Yes.
Okay. So we agree, though. Like, I feel like that's not even an agreement with. It's almost like that's what the movie is. He is the beginning narration. He is the ending narration. It is his look at this case that he's never been able to crack. It's his cowboy that he thinks is the lead. And Chigurh, whether he exists or not, is just his evil that he's trying to find. It's like the simplest thing. This is how it was broken down to me in college. And I was just like, oh, that seems pretty simple. The way my teacher broke it down is that the whole point of No Country for Old Men is that it's even them breaking, in a meta way, the whole structure of a story. And the reason people are so pissed off at the ending is because this movie that's trying to tell you that this officer doesn't know how to deal with evil? If you can't even deal with that, imagine if you can't handle a story not having a regular three-act structure, you are never going to be able to comprehend what Tommy Lee Jones was dealing with there. And it's this idea that old way of telling stories, there's No Country for Old Men, it's gone, it's past. This is a new way, it's a new reinvention. And I thought that's the most fascinating way. I feel I've been Mandela affected, but there is an award that they won out there where I swear one of the Coens says, this is for whoever didn't like the ending. I have been on the search for it all week, Zach, and I know I'm not making this up. I'm going to find it. It is the hardest award speech I've ever heard someone give. And then I remember watching the ending and going like, oh, what? Every time that I've watched it and the older I've gotten, I've actually respected it more and more and more. Yeah. It is an adult movie. I will give you
that. Yeah. No, and that's the thing. Because
it's not
so
for the
much...
boys, it's because it's for the men, Zach.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it, because I don't know if it's a movie that you can really resonate with that ending until you have seen history pass you by a little bit, right? Because like part of it is about like recognizing your own mortality, recognizing that the world changes whether or not you're ready for it to change. And a lot of times it changes in ways that you are not equipped for. And that ultimately is what this movie is doing, right? This sheriff character who has this long history that his father was also a sheriff too, and that he's now faced with a new type of evil and something that he is no longer the right man to confront. He can't stop this. And I think there's some, you know, I think there's a lot of beauty in that whole monologue where he's talking Scary. About catching up with his father, you know, that he's older now than his father was when his father died. You know, that there's something really poetic in that sort of recognition of your own longevity, but also the arc of your own life, and that, you know, not, you can't spend your whole life acting like a young man, because this is no country for old men, right? Like this is not a fit place for somebody of the old generation.
Agreed 100%. Just the fact that he even thinks of our main character as Josh Brolin the cowboy, and then he just dies. Don't even see
it's
his
so
death
sudden.
It's
yeah. And the way
script
they kind
is
of,
almost laughing at you going, oh, this is what you expected. Yoink.
Yeah, they intentionally rob you of the best word I can think of in the moment is like the satisfaction of getting that conclusive moment. Because like you've been spending all this time like on the edge of danger with him, you know, surviving these Shiger attacks, right? You think you're seeing this movie Ooh. About a guy getting away with a bag of money, and then all of a sudden you're pulled back into reality, and you're pulled back into the situation of Tommy Lee Jones, where you're showing up kind of you're showing up too late, right? Like he's running behind these people. He can't keep up.
This man thinks he's going to make it. All of us think that he's going to win and make it out with the money. We don't get that. So then we feel owed that we should at least see his death. And then we don't get that. So yeah, that's how Tommy Lee Jones feels. There's that one shot when he's at the motel and they do that fake out edit. There was never going to be anybody over there. That was the one this time around where I went, that's what my teacher was saying. Got it. He's still there chasing ghosts. Dude, I know they're very, very close to each other. These supporting performances. I think it was him, and then it would have been Heath Ledger, right? They're chaos. Like they back to what was in the water, man, in Hollywood. Back to back years of the supporting actor just being the embodiment of evil, almost this Joker-like character that's coming in. And even a lot of the lines they mean more, but not. I'm not there yet. A lot of the stuff that Chigurh says, right? Which I don't want to be there yet, because it's like, will that be me comprehending evil the moment I understand the coin got here the same way I did?
Well, what I was struck by watching Shakur with on this time is his almost like robotic, cold approach. He operates on this sort of sense of cosmic inevitability, right? Like he uses the coin flips and luck as this way of justifying his own actions, that it's not him choosing to go around and killing all these people, that this is fate that's decided it. And when he kind of, the moments where we see him get a little riled or get a little bit disturbed is when people kind of question that. When the guy in the store doesn't want to call the coin, when he is opposite Llewellyn's wife, Kelly MacDonald, Carla Jean, and she refuses to call call the coin, because like he doesn't want to feel the responsibility of the action, right? It's just fate, it's just luck that I have crossed paths with you, and this is what I do, and you are in my
out of my hands type. I think it's pretty ridiculous. seen the take of this idea that because he sees the world as like this evil place, that the moment, almost like in human psychology, once you start realizing the world is a horrible place, is your viewpoint of the world and how you act in it
right.
also horrible?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the adultness of it. It's almost like you're getting so close to it that the moment you realize how terrible things are, that's also what you make your reality.
Yeah. If you view the world cynically, of course you're going to act cynically, right?
And isn't that kind of what our main character is going through? He's losing his faith. He doesn't believe it. And in a sense, he is almost like thinking that he needs to be this main character, that he's owed something. And I think that's one thing that you see throughout, because obviously it's getting money, right? Our main guy wants to take the money. There's someone after him, the people Chigurh work with. He's also killing them. The whole reason there was a whole shootout is because of greed, right? Every single person, every interaction that they almost had is because of that. When the main guy wants to close, or the gas guy wants to close early because he feels there's danger, and now he's calling him out, why are you closing early if you don't close till later, right? There's those, they weren't teens, they were like a little bit older, who try to make a deal with him for money. The kids at the end who argue about the shirt. Every single thing is like a transaction.
Mm-hmm.
If you're already comparing it to, there will be blood. You're doing anything just to be able to survive in this dog-eat-dog world, and it turns you into that dog-eat-dog world. So I heard them say that they didn't see this as depressing, but, like, the more profound – you were calling it beautiful, you were calling it poetic, and, like, I still see it as profound, but I see it as a little sad. I don't know if I'm missing something that they see to just, like, give in with the wind, but I don't think I don't think it's a bad thing that it's bad. I don't think it's a bad thing it's depressing. I think it's truth.
No, absolutely, and I could see an argument that it's almost like you can just sort of see yourself as like the tiny dot in the spectrum of the universe, right?
Of
like
we're
these specks in the wind, and this is a movie that's sort of arguing about our powerlessness against the course of history. But I do think there is like a sadness in that too. And maybe it's because we're younger than Tommy Lee Jones and we don't want our lives to feel like they're in ending anytime soon. But yeah, no, I think it's totally reasonable to feel both kind of like a profound emptiness with it or just feel the sadness at it. I think there's a lot to take away from it. Earlier, we talked about the other movies that were nominated alongside Fargo at the 69th Oscars. At the 80th Academy Awards, No Country for Old Men won Best Picture over Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, and There Will Be Blood. A pretty incredible Best Picture lineup, if you ask me. Did the right movie win Best Picture that year?
Yeah, I think they're two rivals. Even if I would pick There Will Be Blood on another day, No Country should have 100% deserved it. There Will Be Blood got Best Actor. There Will Be Blood got, what else did it get? I guess they took the screenplay, they took the directing. I will say There Will Be Blood did get Best Cinematography, which No Country didn't. Mm-hmm. Robert Elswit did. And while I think they're both beautiful looking movies, No Country, There Will Be Blood, should have gone to the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. I'm just saying.
I'm just saying.
Two Roger Deakins movies in 1 year?
Yeah, I wonder if that is ultimately what caused it, is that the double nominations for Deakins screwed himself over.
There Will Be Blood
is also a beautiful looking movie. I'm not upset that Robert Elswit has an Oscar.
Through and through, it's fully in there. I think it's worthy of the win. I think it makes sense.
Yeah. We have a video on this channel from, I want to say, 2017, where we asked this question, There Will Be Blood or No Country for Old Men. And I think in 2017, I said No Country for Old Men and you said There Will Be Blood. And you just said you're switching to No Country for Old Men.
I said I switched. I said I just saw No Country for Old Men. Let's do Paul Thomas Anderson next week. I'll tell you what when I rewatch that one. I'm taking the scene where he casts a spell out that lady and throws it out the church, bro. That's crazy.
That's an all-timer. Right now, I might go There Will Be Blood, but honestly, it's like I wake up one day, I feel one way. I wake up another, I feel the other.
You just rewatched No Country and you're going There Will Be Blood?
I don't know. I'm just feeling it right now. I, 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 Yes, honestly, if you ask me tomorrow, I might change my opinion again. I love No Country for Old Men, but these are just two indisputable classics. And this is like,
not a bad year.
I would never make this argument. This is the only argument that I would make. This is the only year when I would make the argument. I wish they tied. I just wish they tied.
Can I throw you some?
Yeah.
I think this year in Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon, we have very similar movies, juggernauts that are fighting against each other. And they're a lot more similar than you think when you're dealing with oil head rights and the evil that permeates throughout the world and what you're supposed to do when you can't take it back and put it in the bottle. Two masterful films from really big auteur directors that have been here a while. We have another Resident 08 in themes. Our hands. Try it. Or tie it, I would say. Tie them.
Yeah.
Because that's another one where I would say it's Killers for me when we recorded, and it still is. But if I rewatch Oppenheimer, I'm going to put Oppenheimer there. So
yeah.
Hey, these are two fantastic movies. I think I really do like – was he – he had been nominated this year. Who gets the demon out the church? Who gets the demon out of the church?
Oh, Paul Dano.
Is it not Riddler?
Yeah, so, he didn't get nominated. I don't know how they overlooked him, but yeah, he did not get nominated for that performance.
What? All right. I mean, I'm going, There Will Be Blood. I'm going, There Will Be Blood. Are you serious?
That was a stacked year for supporting actor. Obviously, Javier Bardem won for No Country for Old Men. Casey Affleck was nominated, probably was the lead of Assassination of Jesse James, but gets nominated in supporting. Philip Seymour Hoffman for Charlie Wilson's War. Not a good movie.
I know.
Great Philip Seymour Hoffman performance.
Yeah, I just saw it the past week. Yeah. And I know you're Michael Clayton fanboy. I'm getting rid of the Into the Wild one because I know I can't argue with you against Michael Clayton. So yeah. That's my spot right there. It would have been Hal Holbrook. No offense to you, man. Yeah. But
he's good in Into the Wild, but yeah, no, it doesn't hold a candle to Paul Dano's.
Paul Dano removed the spirit from that lady, bro.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with that one right now. But hey, fantastic movies.
Absolutely.
One last point right here. Another bit from the Roger Deakins thing when he was comparing them. He says that they shoot so precisely down to the storyboards that at the end of it, only like three shots don't make the cut. He said they used a third of film to shoot and that's it. Because they were, you know, film. They're like, usually you need they shot a third of it. Like two thirds weren't even there. They said, let's reduce it down to this. And there was no room for error. So for it to be that immaculate and then to figure out that they did them a lot on the first try, I'd split up two. I got to do new things at that point. They mastered it. We need them on their own.
Do you have a favorite sequence from this movie? Because there's so many that just stick out to me as iconic quick moments.
A quick one. It scared me when the dog went after him.
Yeah. You know me. I'm not a person who likes seeing dog deaths. He had to shoot that dog.
What else were you going to do? Yeah. That dog was swimming like Michael Phelps towards him. I didn't think he was going to load in time because he had to take the gun because it was wet. Random, but like that scene had me.
It's amazing, and it speaks to that thing that you were just talking about, is that they are so precise in how they craft these sequences that even though there's almost no dialogue, just like you're on the edge of your seat, like is he gonna make it? Is it gonna happen? And to me, that whole bit at the second motel when they start out and he's waiting for the footsteps under the door and then they're running through the street and he gets into the car to try and drive away but ends up crashing. That it is so tense and you never know who is going to end out on top.
To be so methodical and then get in that car crash and still get away. Oh, that'd be my last point here. At the beginning when the thing that starts it all, he tells the guy, the Lobos dude.
Yeah.
He says there's always one guy left. And that's the one guy our sheriff was never able to get. Ah! Okay, I'm going to give it at 8:16. I'm going to give it to No Country. But as soon as the clock hits 8:30, I'm back to There Will Be Blood.
Oh, man. That's Javier Bardem's performance is one of my favorites of all time. Just him walking away with the fracture going through the skin and the kid's shirt wrapped around. It's, oh, my God.
Just with the Igor haircut?
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like if you can make that, you can pull off that bowl cut. I mean, I don't know if he pulls it off, but it works for the character.
He makes it sticks with you. It is even crazy because years later, The cattle prong is
the iconic. Cattle prong is one of the all-time like film weapons or whatever, that nobody had thought to use it that way, and that
so when
you can't use it anymore watching the movie, because this is the iconic
and he pulls
version.
Somebody over, and they're just looking at it, and you're like, why aren't you? Don't you know about? Why would you know about No Country for Old Men in 08? You wouldn't. Exactly. So this person's just like, what are you pointing at me? A balloon, like air thing?
And
like,
it
is this
so
helium?
Terrifying.
Because once you know, you're just scared for the characters. Like, don't you know what he has on him, bro? Through and through, man. Through and through.
All right, so we talked about two of the best Coen Brothers movies. Just between these two films that have won them their Oscar statues, is there one that you prefer? Is there one that's better? Is there one that you want to rewatch more soon?
I think No Country is easily the better film. They're just more trained. I think it is the better film. I almost think that what Roger was saying is on purpose. I do think they were answering some things from Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
That as they got older, they felt differently. That's very profound. But I do think that Fargo is funner.
Yeah.
And maybe the movie I find myself rewatching a little bit more into the future, especially with its series. But every single watch of No Country for Old Men, that's a movie. If I can have a new thing to take away from it, it's just become more and more. It's just one of the best.
Yeah.
One of the best.
Now that I've seen them both several times, Fargo's a movie that I could pretty easily throw on the TV while I'm doing other things. And
Thank you.
Bounce okay. in and I...
You were talking to No Country like it was like that. I'm like, okay, just as long as there's a difference. No Country is fantastic. Like, you can play it whenever. But Fargo is your cleaning movie. I thought you were cleaning to trigger killing people, bro.
No, I'm not that depraved.
Oh, no, dear.
I mean, it's like... You hear the accents, you hear the OGs, Omar-y stuff, and it's just fun to I don't know, I love the world and the characters, but like No Country is the movie that if I put it on or if somehow I happen to like stumble across it on cable, which who does that anymore, but like, you know, you jump in on a certain scene and like I don't know if I could look away is the thing. It's so engrossing and the filmmaking is so perfectly crafted that I tried half watching it and I couldn't. I had to just pay full attention to it. So yeah, Fargo's maybe the easier watch, but I love No Country for Old Men. That's a perfect movie in my eyes.
2000s, best of the decade. It's clearing?
I mean, it's got that and There'll Be Blood. I think those are the top two.
Wow.
And they happened to come out, not only come out months away from each other, but filmed miles away from each other in Marfa, Texas.
You heard? There's one little story, that famous story about how they overly spent the day filming, I think, There Will Be Blood, just to be able to not give the No Country guys a day.
Or the day where they had their big tank.
They ruined it so nothing could be in the shot.
it ruined the day of shooting on No Country. That's so good.
Hey, the competitive nature for it, but both of these movies, definitely some of the best. I think even if we were to make a best of 2000s, these are ones that are making it in the top 10 easily.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Great talk.
All right, so those are our thoughts on Fargo and No Country for Old Men, the Oscar-winning Coen Brothers movie. Let us know what you think about these two movies and which one you think is the better Oscar-winning Coen Brothers movie. And also, what similarities or differences you've seen between them. Really looking forward to hearing from some inner cuties on these classic films that I bet a bunch of people have seen, because they're pretty recent classics. I feel like they still get decent play. So I'm hoping lots of people have thoughts on them. That's all for this edition of the show. You can catch more from me, Zach Shevich, by following me across social media at ZShevich and at Multiplex Show for more videos on YouTube, Instagram, or TikTok. Arturo, where can people find more from you?
You can find me over at LME Movies on Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, all that good stuff. Maybe rewatching The Hudsucker Proxy since it is for kids. All of that good stuff and more. But you can catch me every week here on the Intercut Podcast.
You can listen to every episode of the Intercut Podcast on iTunes, Anchor, whatever podcatcher you like to use. I use Overcast. And then make sure you subscribe not just to our audio feed, but to our video feed as well on YouTube.com/IntercutPod, where you can see our odd faces, just
there
odd
you go.
At the power. power of the Coen brothers as we break through the latest in entertainment. Find new episodes of our weekend must-watch streaming on the YouTube channel every Monday. And please leave us a comment, like the videos. Consider heading over to iTunes to give us that much-requested 5-star review. Like our Facebook, follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, whatever social media you use. You can support us on Patreon. All of them you can find at Intercut Pod. You can also catch a link to our Discord in the description of this episode and find clips from the Intercut Podcast on the Intercuts channel as well. Lots of ways to stay up to date with what we are doing here on Intercut. I didn't mention TikTok. We got Intercut TikTok too. Lots and lots of stuff from the podcast. Thanks again, though, for tuning in to this episode of our Coen Brothers videos. And until next time, call it. Just call it. You have to call it.
It's just 5 minutes of you saying that.